countdown shortly here. In H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Hello, everybody. Today is Saturday, September 24th, in the glorious future year of 2022. Now, what do I have to talk to you about for today? Well, let's see. Just thought I would mention, I'm doing this from home. I found that the Wi-Fi connection in the hotel I've been staying at on the other side of town the last few days just was not stable enough to do shows out of there. I had thought I might be able to have the Peter Beckman speech transcribed and use that, but no dice. I got the cassette machine back from the shop again. I tried to play the Beckman cassette, and it just wasn't playing properly. I played another cassette, and it was fine, so I decided, well, maybe the Beckman cassette is a little messed up. I'll run it on the fast-forward setting, you know, just spool and unspoil the tape a couple of times that way. Well, I got to the end of the tape, and bam! The tape came off the hub. So I am going to have to disassemble the cassette and try and put it back in some semblance of working order. I feel like I may put it into a much newer cassette shell because it is from the early 80s, and also the little pad that holds the tape against the spring that presses against the head, that pad fell off because the adhesive was ancient. So I guess I'm going to have to take the cassette apart and reassemble it in some way. It's enough to make me wish that I had a reel-to-reel machine and I could just wind it up on the reel-to-reel machine and play it that way. Of course, the track format on quarter-inch cassette is not quite the same as the track format on quarter-inch reel-to-reel, but it doesn't matter when it's mono, basically, which this is. Now, I'm afraid I don't have another poem for you today. If you liked that feature, I can see about doing more poetry in future shows. Do let me know. Let's see, I have sent off to people on Nuclear Energy Reddit several envelopes of my Atomic Power to the People and No Blood for Oil, Atoms for Peace stickers, and we shall see. I've encouraged them to make their own posts talking about them when they receive them, because that seems to be what encourages people then to contact me and say, hey, can I get some of those? The whole objective being, of course, to get these into as many hands as possible, spread them around, so people begin seeing this message that, hey, there is another way. There is another route. Let's see, F. Fogg asks, are there pictures of the stickers online? And there are. I'm trying to think. I may not have. Gosh. The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is I'm not sure that I have them up in an easily accessible place. But let me see if I can remedy that. I don't want to stop right now and do it is the problem. But I will post a link in the... tell you what I'm going to do is on the anonradio.net, I do a weekly post for ASFO shows, and I can drop a photo in there. And so in an hour or so, you will be able to see that. You just go to anonradio.net, and there will be a, in the sidebar where it shows recent DJ posts, there'll be a link saying, you know, ASFO 2022 0924. And you go to that, and you'll see the photo. Now, what else is there to talk about today? I had written several topics down in my little notebook, but I seem to have misplaced it, which is characteristic of me. Anyway, but I was going to say I just got on eBay and bought some more vintage nuclear energy badges from Britain. So, you know, visit a nuclear power station type of things. I discovered, because I have a generic one, and then I found that there was one for Hartlepool, which is one of the AGR two-unit nuclear stations in Britain. But, now the theme of this show is always science and technology and the future of humanity with as little emphasis on computers as possible, because so many other people are always talking about that, right? But I am going to talk about computers just a little bit because of a news item that I saw that said that Sundar Pichai, who is the head of Google, had cut in half funding for something called Area 120, which is something within Google that basically provides a way for people working there to pursue interesting new products and projects on the idea that they might be of value to the company later on. In other words, it's sort of a new ideas incubator. Well, Sundar Pichai cut funding for that by half, and told the people, well, I want you to focus, redirect your efforts, focus on AI. Now, it seems really strange to cut funding to the department of the company that has a specific job of coming up with new ideas. Because, of course, if you're in a business where investors are always expecting growth, you'd think that you'd want something that has a promise of new products, new revenue sources perhaps, particularly when regulators are looking to tighten the screws on online advertising, things like that, which, you know, I'm all for, to be perfectly blunt. So, why cut funding to that? And also, here's another question. Why, say, focus all your efforts on AI? Which, in my opinion, is a horse that may not even exist and certainly isn't running in this race. You're going to bet everything on a horse that A, other people are betting on, B, isn't running in this race, and C, may not even exist. And this brings me back to something that I have a photograph of a page out of an IBM manual from the 60s or 70s, I guess, which says, a computer must never make a business decision because a computer can never be held accountable. And I think of this from time to time, because it seems as though a lot of this algorithmically driven, what do you have it, is an attempt to get out from under being responsible for things. That you can say, oh, well, I didn't make that decision. It was the machine. Well, who programmed the machine? Well, nobody programmed it. It's machine learning. It programmed itself. Now, I contrast this, right? This is sort of an evasion of responsibility. People talk about the idea of the objectivity of the machine, the rather questionable idea of the objectivity of the machine. But the other thing that's happening here is an insulation. Well, I'm not the one responsible for this decision. Well, you are, is the thing. And having a business structure which attempts to make that responsibility as remote as possible, I think, is not healthy. But it makes me think of the Hartford Coliseum collapse. Now, the Coliseum in Hartford, Connecticut was built with a space frame roof truss that was designed using then-new finite element analysis tools. And the people using those tools used them wrongly. And the roof collapsed after a snowstorm. And fortunately, nobody was killed. If it had collapsed 4 hours earlier, the stadium was full of hockey fans, I think it was at that time. And if the stadium roof had collapsed 4 hours earlier, 10,000 people might have been killed. As it was, nobody was killed, although a janitor was frightened out of his wits. The thing is, the engineers whose names were on those design drawings didn't get to say, oh, well, the computer made the mistake, not us. No, okay? They were responsible. And the fact that they did not do check calculations, the fact that they did not take the great big printout showing the sizes of all the structural members and take the least loaded, the median, you know, sort of mean load or median loaded element, and then the most loaded element, and do check calculations by hand, and say, oh, wait, this element is perfectly strong enough for the job in compression and tension, but it's going to fail in buckling, given the loads that the software predicts. Because that was the thing. The software was looking for compression and tension failures, did not look for buckling failures. They didn't tell it to do that. They basically didn't put in the correct switches. If they had done those check calculations by hand, they would have seen, oh no, this is all wrong. We're going to have to scrap it and go back and redo the calculations because we forgot to check for buckling loads. And yeah, that's going to take hours and hours of additional computer time because the buckling load calculation is much more complex than the compression and tension failure calculations. But hours of computer time costs a lot less than putting an entire new roof on a stadium and everything that else has to be done after it collapses, right? So the engineers who put their names on design drawings and specifications that they hadn't adequately checked because they thought, well, the computer did it, therefore it must be okay, were held liable and responsible. Now, why am I thinking about this? Well, I just keep thinking, Sundar Pichai, how about Sundar Dome? Because here's the key. Business executives, their whole job is making decisions. And the way that corporate culture in America certainly has evolved, they don't really get held accountable for their decisions very much. I mean, you often hear people saying, well, they deserve big salaries because they take big risks. What kind of risks exactly? None of them is worried about where his next meal is coming from. None of them is worried about being out in the street, right, with no place to live because he can't pay rent. They've got their contracts negotiated so that even if the company goes bankrupt, they still get paid millions of dollars. Very different from the small businessman and the entrepreneur who bears the whole brunt of failure, right? You know, they can fire a bunch of people, put a bunch of people out on the street, and get paid for it. They can do pretty much anything they want to get paid for it. So business executives in the U.S. have become very efficient at making dumb decisions. Well, in that case, how about Sundar Dome? The only thing that people at Google have to come up with an AI that's good enough to do is to make decisions that will replace Sundar Pichai. That's it, right? All they have to do is come up with a so-called AI that will make dumb decisions. It's much easier to build one that makes dumb decisions than one that makes smart decisions, because to build one that makes smart decisions, you firstly have to have a good a priori model of what a smart decision is. That's difficult. You got to come up with a data set to train it on that's all smart decisions. Very difficult. But as with, you know, GPT-3, which is the conversation chatbot, it's essentially a very complex Markov chain that generates a probable response to whatever you say. And so, you know, you can get it to describe the experience of being a living human being if you want to. You can also get it to describe the experience of being a centipede, because all it does is generate, out of an immense probability model, a highly probable form of words, right, in response to whatever prompt you feed it, which has led to amusing prompt injection bugs. Apparently, much of the content on Twitter now is just these bots talking to each other. As I've mentioned before, maybe we can just cut out that whole part of the internet and save energy, save resources, save us all some mental angst and anguish. But you've got people have deployed chat bots that basically you make a post about any subject, and these chat bots are constantly screening for certain keywords, and they'll post a response to it that looks like it might have been written by a human being. And the idea, I don't know, if it's to get you to apply for jobs or get you to hire their service or whatever. But someone discovered that with correctly crafted prompts, you can get them to do things like change what they say to apologizing and for 9/11. Tobe reminds me that, of course, in many American states, the highest paid public employee is a football coach, and in those few states where that's not true, it's a basketball coach. I mean, there's something that really doesn't matter a whole lot, but boy, people are willing to pay for it, which is one of those great conundrums. So yeah, I mean, Google could basically build a Sundar bot, an AI, and save themselves the cost of having a CEO. How do you like that thought? But yeah, speaking of people being willing to pay for things that are ultimately of no consequence, of course I've said repeatedly that I'm not going to try and claim that anybody is going to invest in my space settlement proposals and make a whole lot of money off of them. But I do believe that people will pay for it anyway. Right. If I can find the correct angle, because people will pay for things that they want. And somebody pointed me to the website of the group that's developing a video game called Star Citizen. And over the course of like 5-7 years, they have raised $500 million. Now, I don't know what they're spending it on, but clearly, people who really want to play this video game, they want it enough that they're willing to pay for it, and they're willing to throw in $500 million. Well, as I've said before, my estimate for the sum of money needed to put boots on the ground, to give us the initial encampment, right, the first step leading towards the initial lunar settlement, is about $1 billion. If people are willing to pay $500 million for pretend space travel, that, as I understand it, keeps sort of getting delayed and pushed back and not really showing the results that people have been hoping for and so on and so forth, well then why wouldn't they be willing to pay $1 billion for real space travel? I mean, yes, it's not as participatory as a computer game, but on the other hand, you can point, you know, to the moon in the night sky and say, there are people up there and I helped put them there. Not to mention, I've, you know, discussed, I've thought about, I've talked about ways of making it more participatory. The most obvious bit being the sort of crowdfunding angle of saying, well, the first kilogram of rock samples sent back, half will be given to universities, the other will be divided up among our top backers. And then you'll get a little vial with a sample of moon dust or a little rock and a, you know, 100 milligrams of dust or a 1 gram rock, depending what you kicked in, right, and a certificate of authenticity saying this is from the first group of samples sent back. Because, of course, you know, after 10 years or so, the value of moon rocks will have fallen greatly because there'll be regular supply, etc., etc. But that first batch sent back, that's exclusive, right? These are the kinds of things that I think about. So, as I said in the beginning, or at least implied in the beginning, right, the difficulty then is to formulate the message in the right way to attract people's attention and support, and then disseminate the message in the right way to attract people's attention and support. Because clearly there is a lot of attention and support out there, even now. Now I'm going to go back for a moment to talking about computers, even though, as I said, I don't normally talk about computers on this show, because it's something very interesting. Again, we were talking about engineering and business decisions, and the difference between engineering decisions made by a computer and business decisions made by a computer. And, of course, there's been a lot of talk recently about Microsoft and GitHub and a thing called Copilot. Now, I don't know what people expected exactly. You know, Microsoft sets up a great big repository where you can put up your computer code for free. And people don't expect Microsoft is then going to use that as a way to get computer code for free. I mean, so far as I can tell, the whole thing was never anything more than a honey trap. You know, the whole purpose of it was to get a bunch of coders and a bunch of coding all in one place that Microsoft didn't have to pay for anything more than server bills, right? They didn't have to pay any labor costs for all of that. They didn't have to pay, you know, and so then they created a system that would scrape all that code and then feed it into a machine learning system so that Microsoft engineers or programmers and people willing to pay Microsoft for the privilege could then basically get other people's code, but it's been anonymized by putting it through the sort of washing machine of the AI so they can say, oh no, this isn't copyright infringement. Oh no, we haven't stolen your work. We've used it to train an AI, and then the AI creates original work that just happens to be identical to your original work. Now, whether that actually works is an interesting question all by itself, but it leads me around to something I occasionally talk about on this show, right, which is economics. Now, right now, you have inflation. Everybody is terrified of inflation, and so they're putting in all kinds of stringency measures. And so you have, you know, in New Zealand, they're saying, oh, well, we're going to have to adopt stringency measures. 50,000 people may have to lose their jobs, which is a lot in New Zealand, in order to bring inflation under control. And I say, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Once again, central bankers don't have a button to push that improves crop yields. Right? Food is more expensive to some extent because of poor crop yields. And a big part of that, of course, that adds on to that is the inefficiency of our supply chains, the inefficiency of our distribution systems. You know, how much of what's actually grown makes it to market, makes it to people, makes it to the ultimate consumer, that is to say, your mouth. How much of that? I mean, there are crops that are grown all over the world. A great example that was pointed out to me by Gemlog was the cashew apple. So the cashew nut is the seed of a fruit. The shell of the nut is quite toxic, but the fruit is not, and the fruit finds some uses, but it's one of those things there's not a big world market for, and so a lot of them, they just get thrown away. I don't know, maybe they get used for livestock feed, maybe they get used for making alcoholic beverages, but there are lots of food crops that are restricted to a small area because either they're just unfamiliar. Right, wheat is easy to handle, it's highly standardized, it ships well, you know, it's moved in vast quantities all over the world. Lots of crops aren't like that. There are crops that bruise easily, and so they're difficult to transport. There are crops that spoil rapidly, and so they're difficult to move them to market, and so they become restricted in geographical areas. But there are also some that are just unfamiliar. As it turns out, it's really difficult to get people to eat unfamiliar food. The British in India discovered that if there was a famine in a rice-eating part of the country, that shipping wheat from the wheat-eating parts of the country was absolutely worthless, because the people there would literally starve to death before eating unfamiliar food. Anyway, but there seems to be this superstition that inflation is being driven by rising wages, and therefore we have to drive down wages. That's nonsense, and do you know why it's nonsense? Because you can look at curves, historical curves of labor productivity versus wages. These are the sorts of things that's tabulated, and you discover that labor productivity and wages tracked for most of the, basically the period 1870-1970, they tracked fairly closely. And then labor productivity keeps increasing. It's increasing, 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 even at an increasing pace. And wages have only risen very slowly since the 1970s. In other words, passing over all the other implications of that, the fact is that direct labor costs are as small a part of the cost of providing goods and services now as they ever have been. They're a much smaller part than in the past, which means that wage growth-driven inflation is not an idea that holds water. Now, as a matter of fact, if we want to take a real hard look at economic matters, we may realize that labor productivity, in a sense, is too high, because some of this gain is not from automation, right? It's not from improvements in technology that allow labor to be used more efficiently. It's not even from improvements in education and training that make the laborer more efficient at what he does. In many cases, this appearance of improved labor productivity is given by business practices that schedule the worker within an inch of his life. In other words, you go to the grocery store, and where in 1970 they would have had a checker at each of the check stands, and then a bagger, at least, you know, baggers for most of the check stands, and then somebody to push a mop around, and a floor manager, you know, and somebody at the deli counter, somebody at the fish counter, somebody at the, you know, bakery, and then somebody to push the mop around, and then the floor manager to keep everybody in line. They have half that number of people now, and people are bouncing around between the deli counter and the fish counter and the check stands and mopping up and, you know, all those kinds of jobs. And this is a case of people who are, this is not a case of work smarter, not harder. This is a case of work harder. This is a case where you can no longer tell your boss, hey, I'm taking off for the afternoon because I've got a doctor's appointment. You're scheduled within an inch of your life. And you even get these zero-hour contracts where you're required to show up and then be told whether you're going to work today. Now, I genuinely believe, and I believe I've said this on the show before, that if you're going to be required to show up, you have to be paid some minimum amount for that. Because these are not, I think, good business practices. But the enthusiasm for AI, it seems, is yet another attempt to reduce labor costs by shifting them somewhere else, when, in truth, the labor costs have already been minimized, and any further attempt is just sort of shuffling things around. Well, again, that's my opinion, and I suppose you may want my opinion since you've been tuning in to A Step Farther Out here on AnonRadio.net. I'd love to get your comments. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you want some of those stickers I was talking about, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. You can also support my activities. PayPal.me/Prometheus Lives is a good choice for that. Coming up next is Tobe with the Dubious Gold.
7.